Book 4, Chapter 9, The Beatitudes. Having made his prayerful choice of the men who were destined to be rulers in the kingdom which he had come to manifest, Jesus took an early opportunity of instructing them in the principles of that kingdom. He led the 12 to the foothills which look back over the gleaming lake of Galilee, and upon the villages which fringed its western shore. Reaching a large plateau among the heights, he sat down in their midst and taught them. It was not long before they were joined by the multitudes which had become such a familiar sight wherever he went. The discourse which followed, familiar to us as the Sermon on the Mount, is recorded most fully by Matthew. The greatest intellects of each generation have contributed their meditations upon its teaching, but no man has ever plumbed its depths or ascended its heights. They are words which form the basis of all righteousness. They constitute the rock upon which all Christian endeavor is built. Jesus had come to demonstrate in his life the attributes of his Father. He had come to lift the faces of the sons of men towards the fountain of light and life, to call upon them to abandon their selfish groveling in the darkness of human ambition, and willingly follow him in the cool, clear air of the Spirit, ever progressing towards the perfection embodied in the exhortation which is the climax of the discourse. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. The teaching and precepts of Jesus, expressed in the clear symmetry of the Sermon on the Mount, are not abstract ideals, as beautiful as mountain peaks and as remote, to be preserved and worshipped in devotional hours and ignored in the hurly-burly of daily living. They form a working philosophy of life, which is the only road a disciple can tread. A steep and difficult road truly, but one which Jesus himself was treading. Nor did he demand that his disciples should tread it alone. He reached out his hand and led them towards its summit. Jesus was teaching the 12 and the multitude of disciples who should follow them how to live on his high level. The whole discourse forms a portrait of the teacher himself. In it he reveals the secret of his life. Showing his disciples the way, he describes the fountain from which all his own actions sprang, disclosing a heart dedicated to his Father's will. It is as important as it is interesting to consider the general structure of the discourse. Broadly, it falls into three divisions. The first, which takes us to the 20th verse of the 5th chapter, illustrates with the words, "Ye are and ye have," the basic character of the child of God. By far the largest section, continuing to the 14th verse of the 7th chapter, deals with the outward manifestation of that basic character in the vicissitudes of life, actions which are the inevitable outcome of the spiritual condition and do not have their motives, as the Pharisees, to be seen of men. It is here that the 12 are repeatedly reminded of the distinction between the justice of the Mosaic law, which required obedience to the letter, and the love of the law Christ was giving them, which demanded a response of obedience to the Spirit of grace. Finally, there follows a warning against the stumbling blocks and bypaths on the road to perfection, and a graphic parable which conveys far too vividly for complacency the fundamental importance of man's attitude to his precepts. From this broad analysis, it can be readily seen that the Beatitudes are the seed from which all other aspects burst into radiant expression. The secret of the law of Christ does not lie in the disciple loving his enemies or in turning the other cheek. That is the natural expression of the blessed condition to which he calls them in his opening words. The man who is poor in spirit will not seek the mote in his brother's eye. He that truly mourns will not be guilty of the disfiguring deceptions of the fasting Pharisee. One who is pure in heart will have made those painful sacrifices which have deprived him of offending hands and feet and eyes. He who hungers and thirsts after righteousness will not be over-anxious to get his share of the lesser blessings of this life. As the general sermon submits to analysis, so it is possible to appreciate the symmetry of the Beatitudes themselves. The first great need of the spiritual man is poverty of spirit. From that we are able to advance along clearly defined paths towards perfection. We see the death and then the burial of self-righteousness. The blessings of meekness takes its place. Meekness prepares the heart for the flowing in of spiritual life by a hunger and thirst after righteousness. Consciousness of divine gifts gives birth to a profound sense of gratitude for mercies received, a gratitude which can be only satisfied by a response of mercy to our fellows. Purity increases with the exclusion of all that is foreign to a true reception of spiritual experience. With the singleness of desire and purpose, conflicts of loyalty cease, struggles of the flesh diminish, and the blessedness of peace fills the disciple's heart. Righteousness has ever been at enmity with evil. The more advanced our spiritual life, the more bitter will be the assaults of the powers of darkness, and the more comfort will be found in the final beatitude, "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake." But these fundamental truths, which sum up all that Jesus had to say about discipleship, demand more than a cursory reference. To understand them and attempt to apply them is to be numbered among those who forsook all and followed him. The word blessed, which runs through the Beatitudes, stands not for a passing joy, but for a continuing condition of the heart. "Blessed are" indicates an inner experience, something not controlled by circumstance or regulated by environment, a state of heart, not of life. If the listening 12, or the multitudes of listeners that have followed them, can attain this blessedness which, by God's grace, is the reward of a diligent endeavor to keep these commandments, then all the circumstances, difficulties, and temptations of life will be met and controlled by this condition of a heart which beats in harmony with the heart of Jesus. The first stage in discipline is poverty of spirit, a deliberate renunciation of many things which the flesh finds attractive. Immediately the way of Jesus struck away from the way of men. He taught that self-sacrifice, not self-culture, is the true vocation of those who would follow him. The disciples were shown at the outset that they had to make a choice, even more important than the decision to leave all and follow him. It was impossible for them to travel upon two roads leading in opposite directions. Jesus showed them that they could not begin to accept the gifts of God until they were prepared to give up the prizes the world had to offer. The spirit that fights for its rights, that demands adequate rewards for natural endowments, may indicate worldly wisdom, but that wisdom is foolishness with God. He also showed them that the end of poverty of spirit is not poverty, it is riches. They would commence a journey which leads them high above the thoughts and ways of men to the mind of the Creator. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. When the work of their Master rises to its consummation at his return to the earth, it will be those who have willingly broken their lives and renounced their spirit to serve him who will be the children of the kingdom. In that day, those who have sacrificed the dubious pleasures of a godless world, manifesting a longing, never satisfied desire to enjoy the fellowship and accept the responsibilities that Jesus offers, will receive the unspeakable gift of immortality, and will shine like stars in the kingdom of his Father. Spiritual mourning is the natural outcome of the renounced spirit. When his own temporal ambitions and wants are resolved, the thoughts and activities of the disciple can turn to the need of others. He is able to share their burdens and enter into their sorrows, losing concern for himself, not so much deliberately as inevitably. He begins to manifest love for others. Jesus himself had done just that. In the wilderness of Judea, he had resolved his own problem. He returned to give his whole attention to the needs of men, loving them even to the uttermost. Now, in that same spirit of love, he teaches them that the trials, disappointments, and sorrows of many hearts are concentrated on the heart of the true disciple. Answering his call to a life of love and service, they are entering into the fellowship of his sufferings. The veil of tears lies before them, but by bearing the burdens of others, they would fulfill his law, and with the mourning came the promise of the blessing of comfort. The literal meaning of this word comfort is strengthened by being with. This godly sorrow was to bring to his disciples a companionship more precious than his physical presence, a deep spiritual union from which they would draw strength from his strength. Thus they would receive a measure of peace and joy far exceeding the measure of their grief. Meekness is not weakness, when it is the quality born from the two previous Beatitudes. The spirit of renunciation and the spirit of loving service combine to produce the man who is meek. It is a state which emerges from a breaking and softening process. To the world, it sounds effeminate and tasteless, but upon the lips of Jesus, the eager disciples realized that it was a quality to be found only in the bravest and strongest characters. It is not the natural meekness, suggestive of tameness, which belongs to the placid, easygoing, amiable man. It is the hard-earned reward of a purging, spiritual experience which has demanded a high degree of courage and self-control. The blessing of meekness is inheritance. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. It could not be claimed, in the light of the apostles' subsequent experience, that this blessing was offered to them as a present possession. The earth was under the temporary domination of the proud and the arrogant. Already they had had evidence of the temper of those who occupied the highest places of the earth, evidence that would accumulate until their master hung on the cross. But that would not always be. Although for a season they would suffer under the injustice and cruelty of men, their inheritance remained. An heir is one who was not of age, but who was coming into his possession at some future time. Thus Jesus was sowing in the disciples' mind the seed of a truth, which he was later to develop in many wonderful ways. By a strange paradox, by forsaking the world, they were to inherit the earth. This beatitude is a paraphrase of the 37th Psalm, which gives the picture of evil now prospering and the wicked flourishing as a green bay tree. The godly man is exhorted not to fret over their power, nor be envious of their prosperity. Though he suffer adversity at their hands, he must continually delight in the Lord and commit his ways unto him. The day will come when the evildoers shall be cut off, and the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Although the final reward of the meek will wait upon the return to the earth of their Lord, the disciples would have lost the spirit of their master's words had they ignored the present spiritual compensations that they would enjoy as they strove to follow him. In the very process of their struggles, they would experience a peace passing understanding, a fellowship and a deep sense of communion, which would be for them, and can be for us, an earnest of the eternal inheritance that awaits those who are true sons of God.